The Athletic.
In the final moments away at Brentford on the weekend, Arsenal went top of the Premier League.
Good ball by Saka. There's the chance and there's the goal. It's Kai Havertz for Arsenal.
Kai Havertz hasn't exactly hit the ground running, but could this be liftoff for his Arsenal career?
I know it's always hard when a new signing comes and they pay a lot of money for you, so they think it goes quite easy and quite fast. But I'm just thankful for all of them to keep supporting me.
And with the best defence in the division, are Arsenal a better team? If not quite as fun to watch? I'm Ayo Akinwolere. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. All right, let's get into this. Arsenal winning 1-0 away at Brentford. I'm joined by The Athletic's David Ornstein, also Arsenal writer Amy Lawrence, and also German football writer Raphael Honigstein. Look, Amy, Kai Havertz arriving back post to rescue the day for Arsenal. That clearly was a great moment for the club, but still speculation as to how Kai Havertz works in this team, no?
I was thinking about it before, and so many people have spent quite a lot of time, and it's nearly December, remember? So everybody's entitled to adaptation time, assimilation time. That's fine. It's not been the quickest, I guess, for an established player. And I think quite a lot of the first few months of the season, people have just been scratching their heads going like, where does he fit in? Where does he fit into the team? And you almost would like to have a kind of some sort of inside track into Mikel Arteta's brain and say, what did you picture? You know, what was the plan? Because it's been quite hard to establish, and he's played in various different roles to try and get him firing. I guess that one thing he brings that is undeniable is attacking height. So it was just exactly the right time, I think. A game that they felt they probably needed to win just to take advantage of what others were doing over the weekend. Didn't look like it was happening, struggling to create chances. You know, Saka gets a millisecond away from being double marked and Havertz finished. It was a really nice moment. And it was fascinating because most players, you think, might kind of milk that kind of thing. And again, we're all trying to psychoanalyze Kai Havertz, poor guy. But when you see Mikel Arteta headlocking him and dragging him almost reluctantly over to the away fans, who did not stop singing his name, by the way. You know, Arteta even afterwards said, I did it because he wasn't going to. Which felt insightful and interesting. And there's clearly a fascinating player and a fascinating character in there. And it's just getting him to feel comfortable enough to do his thing and fit into the game plan.
Yeah, Raph, well, I know you've written about Kai Havertz and the pieces on The Athletic right now, but I thought what was interesting about your piece is that based on all the places he's played since Leverkusen, Arsenal, and also Chelsea, and even now with the current German squad, there's a line that really stuck with me. He says, we only ever get a glimpse of him, but never the full picture. But you have a lot of love for Kai Havertz. Tell me why.
Because I have seen the fully formed Havertzness in its pomp. And it's a sight to behold. And I'm wondering, along with everybody else, where this has gone, why we haven't seen it. We've only seen bits of it at Chelsea. We have only seen even fewer bits at Arsenal in a new position, mostly. Arteta clearly has seen enough to be heavily invested, both in a financial and, by extension, in a personal sense, as a coach in him, and is determined to make it happen. But, yeah. Baby steps at this point, baby steps. I think Arteta's big idea was to have two number 10s in two number 8s positions. Odegaard on the right and Havertz on the left and a holding midfielder behind them. And it would offer the sort of the dynamism and the cuteness. But even in Havertz with the height that Amy mentioned, enough of a presence to make it all work. But we haven't really seen that midfield work. I don't know if they're going to get an extended run together. I think away from home, I'm not sure Arteta still believes that this is the best setup. But it could work in theory. It could work on paper. We just don't know yet.
I'm interested by what you said there as the two number 10s playing the two number 8s, which kind of is the first time I think I've really understood the intention. So thanks for that. but even using that Ødegaard comparison is quite interesting because while he was clearly very, very talented as well when he arrived, it still took him longer than you might think to really find that rhythm and really feel comfortable enough to express himself fully at Arsenal. So maybe there's a kind of helpful example there.
Yeah, and there is something I think that maybe works in Havertz's favour. I think everyone at the club understands that Arteta is incredibly meticulous and detailed when it comes to what he wants from his players in the final third. You'd think that more creative players would be given freedom, as you said, to express themselves, but there are very specific rules of what they can and can't do and should do. And somebody close to Kai Havertz told me that Havertz is aware of all these instructions and is trying to fulfill them as best as possible, but maybe in that determination to do whatever Arteta wants from him, something gets lost a little bit at this moment. Maybe it's not internalized enough. Maybe he's still second-guessing himself. And I think those split moments that you miss on the pitch that can make all the difference. He looks a little bit hesitant. He looks a little bit unsure of what he's trying to do at times. And if Ødegaard is the right example, or Fabio Vieira is another example of a player who took a long time to figure out what Arteta wants and then being able to deliver it, maybe this is a different kind of adaptation process. I think we would have all liked to see more output already from somebody who's so expensive and who's had, of course, experience in the Premier League for a while now.
Yeah, I want to talk about Kai Havertz being deployed as a wing back for Germany a little later on, Rafa, but we'll move on and bring David in. And let's go back to what Rafa was talking about. You know, it's a big fee, David. Can you just give listeners a glimpse of what Mikel Arteta, who we've just mentioned is a very specific manager, was looking at when they thought to bring Havertz in?
Well, Arsenal's pursuit of Kai Havertz goes way back before Mikel Arteta. So they were very interested in him when he was a young player at Bayer Leverkusen. They scouted him extensively under the Arsene Wenger regime. So you're talking about recruitment personnel like Francis Cajajal, Peter Clark, Brian McDermott, even Ty Gooden and Danny Kaibatyun. They were watching his debut season at great length. I was told sort of at least 25 games. And so he was on their radar very much. At one point, I think when he was really young, Moore was seen as a development player on the left wing. And then around 2020, before joining Chelsea, it was in the sort of number 10 role. And other players they were looking at around then included the likes of Fekir and Ruiz, even Ødegaard, of course, who eventually came to sign. But they were always in contact with the representatives. And it was about when he would sign a contract with them. When he did, which was always the intention, his value went out of the sort of bracket that Arsenal were looking to spend in those days. And that's why by the time Chelsea came on the scene, Arsenal were not there at that price level. They weren't spending like they seem to be prepared to do now. But that shows that there was background and history to this. Fast forward to the summer just gone and coming towards sort of the springtime, March, I think Arsenal had him on their radar yet again, given he was approaching the final 2 years of his contract. And, you know, it's fair to say they were prioritising somebody like Mason Mount. Ilkay Gundogan was in the mix. There were other names as well, but I think Kai Havertz was in and amongst it, and Mikel Arteta was a firm fan of his. And so I think it was he who was sort of driving this. Edu, as sporting director, was on board as well. And it really developed very quickly. When Havertz started to be linked with Real Madrid in particular and Bayern Munich a little bit too, I started to check this out and was told, no, not so sure. You know, Bayern were there a little bit. Real Madrid, they were waiting to see what was unfolding with Harry Kane, etc. Once he found out about Arsenal's interest, I'm told that there was a Zoom conversation with Mikel Arteta and Havertz was fully committed to Arsenal. That was his desire. There's a very different sort of perception in the public to the reality in private and what people see of Havertz sort of behind the scenes and how they're working to make him most effective. Don't forget that he's learning a new role at a new club with a new group of players who had pretty much solidified their way of playing last season, and he comes into it. And it is going to take some time, but I think, you know, everything I hear suggests that firstly, he's ultra committed and dedicated and football obsessed to get this right and work with the coaches. And furthermore, his attitude behind the scenes and the application that he puts in, his conduct, which is something I heard at Chelsea as well, beyond reproach. Like he really is a very popular character with players and staff and away from the pitch throughout his career. He's worked with physios for his recovery and conditioning and things like that. So I think you saw some good signs in pre-season, and you actually saw this back post routine that was then executed again at Brentford on Saturday. There's an appreciation that it's going to take some time, and he's a shy guy. So I think there was a lot of goodwill towards him, not because he's had a crisis in confidence or anything like that. I think there's been a bit of a misinterpretation on that too. I hear that he's very confident and calm and not fazed by what's going on. But because he's shy, I think they all sort of wanted to galvanize around him. And I hear they were singing his song in the dressing room as well, and really sort of a huge amount of goodwill for him due to that popularity. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk more about sort of his physical attributes. But another misconception in the public is, you know, maybe his style. But don't forget how tall he is and the sort of the stride length. You know, it was described to me as being sort of the difference between a long distance runner and a sprinter. A sprinter might make these shuttles and then be exhausted, but somebody like Havertz just goes and goes and goes. And that's why his distance is covered. His pressures are so high. And also the passing lines that he covers from an attacking perspective and a defensive one as well. So he's cutting out a lot of developing attacks from the opposition early on. I think the Germany left-back experiment was a bit of an anomaly, and they've got really high hopes for him, and perhaps that was kick-started at Brentford on Saturday.
Yeah, Amy, you're sort of nodding there, and I just want to throw this one to you because we've spoken about how great a player he is. Rafa's seen him in Germany. He knows what he can do, full steam, languid as it may be. But can we also just exercise some patience here? You know, we look at the fee. Can we just let go of the fee? We look at Darwin Nunes, for instance, at Liverpool. You know, big fee.
I think people have let go of the fee. I think there has been a lot of patience. Do people round the table not think that there's been
externally
quite a lot of patience?
I think the fee has maybe skewed the perception. You see a lot of memes and things on social media, and when it, you know, he hasn't started as prolifically as maybe you'd expect for a £65 million player, and then you look at other players elsewhere in that sort of role. Somebody like Kudus has done great at West Ham so far for a lower value, and he was a player that Arsenal kind of considered among many players in that sort of number eight role, and perhaps he's been an easy target for external criticism. But Amy, you can't, you do understand the sort of fan reaction to an extent, because when you sign a player for that money with his pedigree, you'd probably expect him to be scoring a little
course,
bit more,
but
and maybe he would have himself.
I think there's a difference between fan reaction or public reaction and fan reaction within the Arsenal community. I'm not just talking about people at the training ground or whatever, who see him every day, who get to know him personally, who are obviously going to have a different view to anyone else out there that's just got to use their imagination. But yeah, I do think that the Arsenal supporters have found it tricky. You know, he's essentially coming to the team to replace a guy in Granit Xhaka who had a massive personality. I mean, in something, personality stakes really at very opposite end of the scale to Kai Havertz. He does seem to be quite a shy, humble guy. And Xhaka wore his emotions, you know, tattooed on his forehead virtually. So going from someone they had a very strong relationship with, who was quite responsible for some of the kind of atmosphere, especially positively in the last year or so, to someone that they don't know yet and they're kind of trying to comprehend, I think they have tried to be as patient and supportive as you probably could be with someone that comes with such a big price tag. How's he regarded in Germany, Raf?
Well, with the same sense of we can't quite figure out what's happening to him, because he was such an incredible talent. I remember there was a big debate, at least in some quarters, whether Bayern were right to pursue Leroy Sané when perhaps Kai Havertz was the more promising generational talent. I mean, I myself wrote that he was a generational talent, and that was certainly the view at the time. And he hasn't quite delivered yet. I think Chelsea, as we know, has been a very difficult place for attacking players full stop to shine in recent years. So it wasn't all down to him. I think that ultimately the false nine position in a team like Chelsea that was quite direct and a little bit unstructured didn't do him much favour. I think he needed a lot more possession and a lot more people around him. And that's why I had high hopes for him coming into this deeper role at Arsenal. But it hasn't worked out as well, certainly not as quickly as I thought it would be. And yeah, for Germany, it's the same. I mean, he scored important goals in the World Cup in a game that ultimately wasn't important at all against Costa Rica. Tried to play as a false nine, and there was a big clamour for Niklas Füllkrug to start games. So again, he was sort of on the wrong side of the public opinion, if you will, during the World Cup. And then since, of course, we've seen that wing-back experiment, which coincided with two very bad performances from Germany, losing against Turkey and Austria. So he's still, as he is in England, to a certain extent, a man in search of his natural role, natural position.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwalere.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I wonder if there's a part of it. You think about Leverkusen. Has he afforded himself the opportunity for a team to play around him? He's clearly a fantastic player here, but where do you put him in the team to get the best out of him? Has he afforded himself that superstar kind of like, we'll pivot around Kai Havertz or not? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we go back to the beginning of this conversation because we don't really see Havertz fully express himself and playing to his limit in any of those positions. That then makes it harder for coaches to say he has to play in this specific position. Doesn't matter what happens around him. He plays at teams, well, for Germany and Arsenal, where there are players in similar position who are more reliable at this point. And it's very difficult for any manager to say, I believe in the player so much, he has to play there, even if he doesn't fully deliver. And that's why his versatility plays against him, because he can play in many different formations and positions. Managers want him involved, but he's being sort of put into an existing system that kind of works independently of him to a certain extent. And he hasn't made neither team his team, hasn't made his position at either team his position. And Germany especially are so stacked with attacking midfielders or wingers that unless he plays a false nine where there isn't that much competition, it's also hard to say this moment in time he should play rather than Jamal Musiala, he should play rather than Leroy Sané, he should play rather than Florian Wirtz or Julian Brandt. All these players are more consistent, even if they might not all of them have the same ceiling as he has. So I don't know how you're going to get out of that vicious circle of him not showing his full potential in perhaps a slightly wrong role to having that extended run in a role that will show the full potential to the extent that nobody can argue anymore.
But Raf or Amy, maybe he is showing, okay, not full potential yet, but to the people in the game, so players and coaches, they seem to love him. I've spoken to a number of players. When Arsenal signed Havertz, they were like, this is an absolutely massive signing for them. And coaches who work with him see qualities that maybe are less obvious to the casual observer on the outside. So perhaps it's not a spectacular, as Ayo says, sort of build the team around me type player, but he plays a fundamental role. It's just that it may not be as eye-catching as many people thought as he came through in football. And don't get me wrong, there's still clearly a lot to be worked on. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been on the bench at Brentford on Saturday, for example. But if somebody like Mikel Arteta swears by him and he's thought so highly within the German national team, and let's remember that Arsenal right now are sitting top of the league and he's played a part in that. So are we being a bit harsh? I don't know.
I mean, I think you're right to say Mikel sort of swears by him, but he swore by Willian. And, you know, you have to regard things individually. And, you know, the every single transfer in the history of football comes with an element of risk. You know, you can do as much homework as you want. You can get as many scouts and as many reviews and as many pieces of data as you want to help you make your mind up. But in the end, it just happens sometimes that things, for whatever reason, that maybe you can't see possibly going wrong, just don't. I mean, I still look at Antoine Griezmann, for example, a player I love, and think, what was that at Barcelona? You know, he's such a fine player, and it almost seems so strange that it just didn't happen at all. But, you know, sometimes the fit, for whatever reason, is not quite right. Just on Havertz, there's a couple of things. Am I mad in actually quite liking the idea of him as a false nine, even if that wasn't the intention? Because I still think in a team like Arsenal's rather than Chelsea, that I can visualise that if he finds his confidence actually being quite interesting and effective. And secondly, you know, you just mentioned, David, this idea that, you know, obviously you don't necessarily get him to be the man that you build a team. I don't know if you build a team around an individual anymore in the way football has become so ultra competitive, but is he still got a notion about him that he's a bit of a luxury player in an age when there aren't that many luxury players? I mean, you know, there are people who make that comparison to him being like a kind of tallish Ozil type.
Ozil, yeah, that's the likely.
You know, I don't know yet. I still feel like I don't want to make any judgments yet. I'm still kind of waiting and hoping, and I wouldn't say expecting, but let's just see if there can be a bit more of a click where he can find more of the consistency and more of the output that makes everything make more sense.
I think David is right. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that perhaps we don't really pick up so much, and coaches love it, love his positioning, love his behaviour, love his cleanness, on his technique, etc. At the same time, I'm always a little bit suspicious when coaches are overly complimentary of a player. And Nagelsmann last week was a perfect example. Having come up with this experiment that nobody could quite understand, he then said after the Turkey game, Havertz had a world-class performance, which I think really stretched credulity a little bit. He did score a goal, but I think world-class was a little bit over-egging the pudding. And the same you get sometimes with Arteta. I think Arteta's backing is real. I think it's genuine. I hear from people close to Havertz that he gets a lot of support from within the club, from within the dressing room. And I think you see that. You saw that when he got given almost a penalty.
He hasn't scored in his last 20 club appearances. Could he get his first goal for the Gunners here?
As a way of sort of getting him involved more, the penalty against Bournemouth, I think that showed you just how much people want him to succeed and clearly rate him, because at this level, no one wants a player to succeed simply because he's a nice guy. They want him to succeed because they think there is something very special and they want to help him. So that part is genuine. But at the same time, as I said earlier, I think Arteta is very heavily invested in this working out. If at Arsenal you sign a player for this kind of money and it doesn't work out, I think that makes a massive difference. It has to work out to a certain extent if Arsenal's trajectory is to continue.
It's interesting that there wasn't this massive market for him, it seemed, at the price that Chelsea wanted, which was around £70 million, reportedly. And so it took some sort of manoeuvring for them to come down. And then still a bit of surprise when Arsenal came in at the 65, because it wasn't as if they were in a battle. And some of those other players that they were looking at or linked with were of a lower price point, certainly in the case of Mount, Kudus, people when they were mentioning Barella. I mean, I even spoke to people at Chelsea who knew that he wasn't playing in his finest position, especially last season. And I saw a lot of them then. And they thought, whether it be staying at Chelsea or moving elsewhere, that he would actually be most effective in the Mount type role. But because they'd had Mount there before and they needed a focal point of their attack, they were sort of having no choice but to put him there. And to Amy's point on the false nine thing, I remember back, we were at Wembley for the Community Shield, and I know that's just an exhibition match, but he actually caused Man City a few problems and Arsenal won that day. I just don't think, from the people I speak to who know a hell of a lot more than me, that him having his back to goal is where anybody sees him. He's on a high salary, sort of in the region, basic salary of £275,000 a week, which Arsenal sort of matched from what he was on at Chelsea. And that comes with some emphasis as well. We kind of all expect to see something like outwardly glamorous, and perhaps the role at the moment is a little bit more subtle.
Yeah, and also I think the contrast between him and Odegaard is so stark. Odegaard picks up the ball in similar areas on the right. You feel something is about to happen. There's so much energy, so much dynamism. Every move seems to kind of threaten the opposition. And Havertz is a lot more safer in his distribution, doesn't take on players. He's not a dribbler. And it looks slow. And I don't think it necessarily is, but it looks slow with him. And you just don't get that sense of excitement and sense of, yeah, something might happen. And then when you see people kind of on social media defending him and putting, you know, little high clips together of his highlights, you see like a player, you know, doing a lot of good stuff, but not really the stuff that necessarily gets people out of their seats and thinks, wow, you know, Havertz made such a difference again for us today.
Well, I tell you what, let's get down to Havertz's numbers. Here's Mark Carey with the lowdown.
Kai Havertz's goal at the weekend was just his second of the season, and many fans will point to his lack of productivity in attack as one of his key shortcomings at Arsenal so far, but it's clear that Havertz is valued by Mikel Arteta for the work that he does off the ball. Now, it might not make his highlights real, but Havertz is really intelligent in his defensive positioning, and he doesn't shy away from a challenge when he needs to.
Kai Havertz, he pulled the header out from Shaw.
Oh, what's he doing?
Kai Havertz, absolutely mad. Just when it was simmering anyway, he has brought it to the boil.
What is he doing?
And the numbers back this up when looking at all Arsenal players to play 500 minutes or more in the Premier League this season. First up, we can look at Havertz's volume of true tackles. Now, this is tackles plus challenges lost plus fouls committed to essentially provide a clearer idea of a player's tendency to stick a foot in, if you like. And when controlled for possession, Havertz's 6.4 true tackles are the third most in the Arsenal squad, which shows that he adds plenty of bite to the team out of possession. And similarly, his tendency to read the play and display that intelligent defensive positioning is shown by his 1.4 blocked passes per 90 minutes. Now, this is the second most in the Arsenal squad. Of course, these aren't going to be the primary attributes that Arsenal have brought him in for, but Havertz has been really effective off the ball and has been a key reason why Arteta's side have improved defensively overall so far this season.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwolere.
We just heard about how good Kai Havertz is out of possession. And also, if you think about it, the team are better defensively. But Amy, you've written about this, and I quote you on this. You say that results are similar, but the feeling is slightly confusing. The enjoyment not quite as accessible. I mean, the fireworks of last season just aren't there this season, are they?
I likened it to a difficult second album. It feels to me as if Arsenal are trying to do something a bit differently, and they're in the process of like trying out essentially, you know, different rhythms and different harmonies and maybe turning electric where they were acoustic. It's just the vibe is not the same. And it is a slightly tougher watch. But, you know, that's just a fact, because last season so much emphasis was on this kind of fizzing attack and, you know, really like going for it. But you can see the thought process very easily. I mean, it makes sense for when you look at what happened last season, how do you take this team up a gear? And the most obvious thing was that defensively, Arsenal gave away far too many easy chances with individual errors and were just not solid enough. The goals against record was not as strong at all compared to their goals for record. So particularly the introduction of Declan Rice has just been majestically successful. And that trio that he forms with Saliba and Gabriel is arguably as good a base as anything out there for a football team. And structurally, that has helped Arsenal immeasurably to become a different proposition, I think, in terms of their solidity and having that reliable base, notwithstanding a few goalkeeping howlers or this or that, that, you know, they haven't been punished for in all cases. But, you know, they've still got their wobbles, but they seem fundamentally much more resilient and much more robust. I think it's pretty impossible to probably change the defensive side without sacrificing something of the electricity in attack. Yeah, if they can somehow marry some of the attacking instincts of last season with this more refined defence, I think it's going to be very interesting, but it's a hard trick to pull off.
Yeah, let's stay with the music analogy. Rafa, you nodded at the difficult second album quote from Amy. I mean, look, our team's just sussing Arsenal out. They've seen what they can do last season. This team, this season's going to be much more difficult. You've seen how isolated sometimes the wing players like Martinelli and Saka are to nullify that classic attack that Arsenal perfected last season.
Yeah, there's an element of that. I mean, Arsenal were a surprise package still last year, but I think it's more to do with these processes that are so important. I can't remember who made the point to me, but after a game, somebody was saying, look, the left-hand side is all new. You know, we don't have the same kind of, again, relating to Kai Havertz, we don't have the same kind of rhythm that we had last year when they played together for such a long time and everyone knew what they were doing, or the right side now. And I guess there's something in that. But in a way, this should be very encouraging. We haven't seen Arsenal play that well yet. But they're top of the league with nearly a third of the season gone. And that is very encouraging. And they've done that while playing in the Champions League, which for a young team, or young in the sense that they're still fresh as a unit, is quite difficult and exerting as well. So let's see the positives. Let's say that they can still harmonize better and find their groove a bit more with more practice.
Yeah, I'm with the guys on that famous last words, but just looking at their fixtures, they don't play so-called big clubs, the biggest, back-to-back at all for the rest of the season. So maybe you could say they play Chelsea followed by Man City. Obviously, it hasn't been the best last couple of years for Chelsea, but otherwise it's relatively inviting, and they haven't been ravaged by injuries so far. They've got Smith Rowe to come back, for example. Watching them at Brentford, it's just one game, but I very rarely in recent years remember them controlling away from home quite as authoritatively as that. Now, you can point to the close shaves on Ramsdale, but they were kind of isolated incidents that weren't the repercussion of a destability in the team, lack of stability in the team. And the way from the centre halves, Zinchenko into Rice, who I just think has been an incredible signing, and the control from the attacking players of Saka and Jesus in particular, of course, maybe not as prolific and they're not finishing chances, and it was a slender lead that turned into a victory. But I think they're in like quietly really good shape. Let's see if they can do anything in the January transfer window, what the finances will be, which you suspect, given how last summer ended, only doing the Raya deal on loan, suggested they're quite close to the line on FFP. So I don't know what maneuverability there is there. And, you know, you do hear of a possible midfielder still, depending on what happens on Partey and Jorginho. The striker thing sounds like it will be addressed more probably in the summer. But, you know, looking at form of other teams, injuries and availability for Arsenal to be sitting at the top of the table right now, I think they'll be in really confident mood.
Yeah. Amy, it's a final word on this from you then, really. Would you say Arsenal are in a better position overall then compared to last season, especially at this stage in the season?
I would, mostly because they've got a bit of experience behind them and they have, theoretically at least, I think, improved their squad. It's really a shame not to have Timber, who I think would have been an absolute star in this team already. And if there are, you know, if he can possibly get back any sooner, that he manages to feature into the new year before the season's out, that would be really great. But Declan Rice, it's difficult to overstate what a monster he has become, like, in every way, physically, mentally. He leads by example. He's got such a presence. I think that he has really changed things. It's about keeping players fit. That was really Arsenal's downfall, the cluster injuries, losing Saliba and not having a replacement of the quality of, say, Tomiyasu was really damaging. So I think fitness is huge and they will be trying to improve together. And they've certainly got the attitude for that. You know, they've got the manager who's driving that into them and they want to do it. So bring it on.
Thanks so much, you guys, for your time. Amy, Rafa, and also David, of course. Remember to rate and review the podcast. If you've been enjoying it, don't forget to sign up to The Athletic today for a special limited offer of just £1 a month for 12 months at theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Athletic Football Podcast. The producers were Adonis Pratsides and Guy Clark, with additional production by Mike Stavrou and Jay Beal. The executive producer was AD Moorhead.
The Athletic.